Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for August 16th, 2024. We are coming to you from the back-to-school department here at the Georgia Historical Society on the 15th floor of the Jepson House, overlooking beautiful Forsyth Park in downtown Savannah. We welcome you back to our eighth season of podcast here on Off the Deaton Path. This is the first one of our eighth season. It's been about 3 months since we were with you last, and we appreciate you joining us. We've got a great season lined up for you with lots of what I believe will be some very interesting and fascinating discussions with a lot of different authors about their new books, forthcoming books. Some are already out. Some will be out later on this year. Some of them already prize winners, and others, I am confident, are soon to be. So more on that in just a moment, but a lot coming up here in our eighth season on Off the Deaton Path. I hope you had a good summer. I hope you did something interesting. Certainly there were interesting things going on, not only in our country, but around the world over the last 3 months. Wow. Let's talk about the most consequential week of the summer and try to put it into some historical context. I'm talking, of course, about the week of July 13th through the 21st, which was technically 8 days, but one of the most momentous 8 days, I think, in American history. Of course, on Saturday, July 13th, there was an attempted assassination of President Trump at a rally in Pennsylvania. You know all about that. He survived it. His iconic picture was in the news the next day, and the Republican National Convention began on that Monday in Milwaukee. And it just seemed to be like a coronation almost because of the events that had happened. We know that on June 27th, the earliest presidential debate in history took place, both sides taking a gamble in doing that. And strangely enough, it kind of worked out poorly for both sides, I think. We know what happened to President Biden in that debate, and he wanted that debate early because he wanted to put to rest the idea that he was not up to the job of being president. And, of course, that backfired spectacularly. There was some risk in President Trump agreeing to one that early. He dominated that debate. But of course, because of that debate, after the Republican National Convention on Sunday, July 21st, President Biden withdrew from the race. Unprecedented. That really just 3 months and some change out from the election, one party's nominee withdraws. Just absolutely unprecedented. To back up just a moment, the assassination attempt, I think the only other assassination attempt in the middle of a presidential campaign was in 1912 when Teddy Roosevelt, there was an assassination attempt on him. He was, of course, the Bull Moose, the Progressive Party candidate running against Woodrow Wilson and William Howard Taft, the Republican nominee, who had been, of course, his handpicked successor. There was an assassination attempt. He was actually shot in the chest before he went on and gave a speech in Milwaukee, strangely enough. Apparently his speech and his glasses that were in his coat pocket helped deflect the bullet. It didn't go to his heart. He went on to give the speech in Milwaukee. There have, of course, been other assassinations and attempts in American history, but not during the presidential campaign. So for people who got up on that Saturday morning, July 13th, by the following Sunday, the world had politically had completely been turned upside down. And if you've been following events at all, you know that the presidential race has just been upended. So it's going to be very interesting to see how it all plays out. But of course, being a historian, it always makes me think, what other weeks have there been like that, where this almost your head has to be on a swivel because things are coming at you so fast? And of course, the one that comes to mind, I think, immediately is April 1865. The American Civil War had been going on literally for 4 years by April 1865. On Sunday, April 9th, Robert E. Lee surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia of the Confederacy to General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox, Virginia. There is much rejoicing on one side. There is absolute desolation on the other, depending on where you stood on things. So this war that had brought death, destruction, disease, was suddenly over, at least that part of it. Now, it wasn't entirely over. Joseph Johnston still had to surrender. There were troops, of course, in the West that had to surrender. But Lee's army was the big prize. On that Sunday, April 9th, Palm Sunday, Lee surrenders. So there's great jubilation. President Lincoln visits Richmond, the Confederate capital, that week. And on the following Friday, April 14th, of course, he goes to the theater that night and is shot. He is assassinated and shot in the head by John Wilkes Booth on Good Friday. And the following morning, on April 15th, 1865, the president is dead, which changes everything going forward in terms of how Reconstruction played out. I just did sat down to do an interview with my friend Roger Smith, which was posted on Off the Deaton Path, about some of this. We posted it on August 1st. If you haven't taken a look at it, I think you would enjoy watching it, about the differences, about, among other things, I discussed the differences between Andrew Johnson and Abraham Lincoln and their views on Reconstruction. So again, if you woke up on that Sunday morning, April 9th, by the time you woke up the following Sunday, the world had changed tremendously in 1865, a range of emotions that Americans felt about what had happened that week in their country. Also, April 1945, I think, was a, obviously, for all kinds of reasons, there was so much going on in that month. President Roosevelt, who had been elected four times to the presidency, died on April 12th, which was the end of an era, obviously, tremendously important. But really, if you look at the 4 days, beginning on April 28th, which was a Saturday in 1945, the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini was captured and executed on that Saturday. The following day, April 29th, the Allies liberated the concentration camp Dachau, and all the horrors of the Holocaust began coming out, photographs and newsreels. The very next day, on Monday, April 30th, Adolf Hitler committed suicide in the bunker in Berlin. He had been fully aware of what had happened to Mussolini and the public spectacle of his death. He was publicly executed, his body hung up. Hitler was not going to let that happen to him as the Allies were moving in on Berlin. And the following day, May 1st, Goebbels died. His communications propaganda minister, one of the top Nazis, he and his wife, they killed themselves and all of their children. So over the span of 4 days, and of course, just 7 days later on May 8th, World War II in Europe ended. So a tremendous amount going on in the span of a week plus there in April 1945. Some of it could have been predicted, but events happened so fast and the emotions, the range of emotions that people felt across the world. So just one of the things that I thought about over the summer was we were living through and continuing to live through, I think, one of the most, I use this word, interesting periods of American history, certainly American political history. There's just so much going on right now. Again, your head's kind of on a swivel with all the things that are going on. But I thought that was very interesting. And by the way, I did a Off the Deaton Path video back on May 1st, 2020, which you can find on Off the Deaton Path at deatonpath.georgiahistory.com about the fall of the Third Reich and those events of April 1945, which at that time were 75 years ago, now 79 years ago, of course. Turning our attention now to one of my favorite subjects, although not necessarily this year. I always talk about our beloved Atlanta Braves, and I wrote about them back in the spring. That, you know, baseball season always springs eternal, and we would see what would happen. I certainly talked about them last fall, what happened to the Braves. Last year's team was just phenomenal. One of the greatest offensive teams in baseball history. They just set all kind of records. They were so much fun to watch. You will recall that that team, if you didn't see the first inning every night, you missed them scoring five or six runs in the first inning. It was something to behold. Not so much this year. I actually, again, on Off the Deaton Path, posted what looked like a wanted poster or a missing poster that you often see when a person goes missing back on June 13th, called Have You Seen This Team? Call MLB Now, Major League Baseball. It was all done tongue-in-cheek because the Atlanta Braves got off to a red-hot start in April and then have really gone cold since then. They've managed to kind of tread water and keep their record just slightly above 500, but I've never seen a baseball team be so good one year offensively and the next year with virtually the same people, minus one or two. Obviously, Ronald Acuna, who was MVP last year, was a huge loss, but even before he went down in May, this team was not hitting, and they have not really been hitting since, not consistently. They win games here and there by big margins, but then they also maddeningly lose them as well on nights when they just get shut out. Unbelievable. It seems like when our pitching is doing well, the offense isn't going well, they're not hitting. And when our hitting is happening, our pitching is bad. So it remains to be seen. This is how baseball is. A long season, teams that you give up for dead in April suddenly come alive in August. And the Arizona Diamondbacks went all the way to the World Series last year. They are reigning National League champions. They got off to a bad start. I had kind of put them to bed. And they're red hot. They are now the first wild card team. And the San Diego, well, they're really tied with the San Diego Padres. Again, people had written them off earlier this season. The Braves seem to be a lock for a postseason position. They no longer are. I think we've got a real fight on our hands. The strange thing about it is the Phillies have suddenly gone cold, and winning the National League East for what, a seventh or eighth year? I can't remember what it is exactly right now, but it's still within reach. Not out of, we've got six or seven games left with the Phillies, so head to head. So going to be very interesting, but the baseball season has been, if you're a Braves fan, a little disappointing and not as much fun to watch, not to mention, of course, they disappeared from Comcast for 2-3 months right in the middle of the season, did nothing to help the fan base whatsoever. You could still see them on DirecTV and Fubo, but, you know, inexplicably, this whole Comcast thing has just been ridiculous. Anyway, I hope, changing gears slightly, that you got a chance to see some of the Olympics, particularly the U.S. men's and women's basketball teams, some of the greatest gold medal games ever played, some of the greatest basketball ever, gold medal game or otherwise. U.S. played France in the men's and women's finals, and they were both terrific games. Some of the best talent you will ever see playing basketball in both of those games. And congratulations, they both came out victorious. Congratulations also to France. Boy, they're going to be teams to watch going forward. International basketball has really caught up with the United States. I think this team that we just put on the court for the men's, probably better than the Dream Team of 1992. I don't think there's any question. Certainly internationally, Serbia, France, Canada, Australia, all these teams are really good. Germany almost made the finals. And I think that the time is not too far distant in the future, and this is hard to say, but I think we're going to see a really, really, really good men's and women's basketball team lose to another team in the gold medal game in the Olympics. And it will not mean that we're failing, as I think it did in 2004. It just means the rest of the world is getting really, really good at the game of basketball. We've seen that in baseball. Most of the best players don't come to the United States anymore. And so it's really kind of fun to watch. It has made all of this, I think, much more interesting. But the Olympics were quite a spectacle, as they are every 4 years. We'll look forward to the Winter Games coming up in 2026. So I want to turn our attention now to something that, you know, for a long time on this podcast, I used to do something called This Week in History, where I talk about the different events that happened on certain days in history, this particular week that I would be talking about. But one of the things I want to do now, you might call it fun facts known by few. It's a little more, I hope, interesting than that. And this is based on, I subscribe to and use quite frequently the Encyclopedia Britannica online. And one of the things you can sign up for on their website, and it is terrific, is something called One Good Fact. And they'll send you something in your email every day. And some of them are okay. And some of them are fascinating. You really, it's one of those things where you want to go, what? What the? And you want to learn more about what that is. And I thought for this segment of the podcast, and I will do this periodically through the year, is just sort of give you a taste of some of these and then dig a little bit deeper, because I was like, these fascinated me. So first up, and this comes from May 21st of this year, and this will give you an idea of about how long these things are. You always read the subject first, and then you read the body of the email. And the subject of this one is, what ancient secret weapon still confounds modern scientists? This is from May 21st of this year. The longevity, and here's the email, the longevity of the Byzantine Empire is in part attributed to its use of a substance called Greek fire. First used in 673 in the Common Era, the highly incendiary substance was nearly impossible to extinguish, helping the Byzantines repel fleets of enemy ships. The recipe was a closely guarded secret, and its exact composition is not known today. Now, how is that possible? It's just fascinating. This is one of those where I thought, what the? And you go and you look to read a little bit more. So, of course, these days we just Google these things. And so here's what came up about Greek fire. This is from Wikipedia, so take it for what it is. But this, I wanted to know, like, do they really not know what this is? Well, of course, they have some pretty good theories about what it was. But the fact that long ago, in the Byzantine Empire, they were using this stuff. And here's what it said. I'll just read part of it to you. Greek fire was an incendiary chemical weapon manufactured in and used by the Eastern Roman Empire from the 7th through the 14th centuries. The recipe for Greek fire was a closely guarded state secret. Historians have variously speculated that it was based on saltpeter, sulfur, or quicklime, though most modern scholars agree that it was based on petroleum mixed with resins. Here's the interesting part, comparable in composition to modern napalm. Oh my goodness. Byzantine sailors would toss grenades loaded with Greek fire onto enemy ships or spray it from tubes. Its ability to burn on water made it an effective and destructive naval incendiary weapon, and rival powers tried unsuccessfully to copy the material. What the? Are you kidding me? Using something like napalm in the 7th century. So that, I had never heard of and didn't know anything about. Next up, this is from July 9th of this year. And the subject, are you living in the nuclear sponge? S-P-O-N-G-E, sponge. And here's what it said. The United States installed many ICBM missiles. You'll remember that stands for Intercontinental Ballistic Missiles in 7 sparsely populated states toward the middle of the country during the Cold War. This area is known as the, quote, nuclear sponge, as it might draw fire away from the more densely populated coast in the event of a nuclear war. Do you understand what they're saying here? And that's the post. I thought, now this one I have to read more about. They're basically saying that they put these nuclear missiles in these states that don't have, quote, very many people. I don't know how you decide what very many is, but, and the idea that in the event of a nuclear war, they would draw the attention away from places like New York or Los Angeles. There's no getting away from that fact. So I had to read more about this, obviously. And I want to read you, this is from an article entitled Welcome to America's Nuclear Sponge. And this was in 2017, written by Tom Kalina, an expert on nuclear weapons, for the website Defense One. And I'm going to read a good bit of this just because it's all worth quoting, and it explains the mindset. And it's not surprising, really, when you go back to the Cold War, that the fear of communism was so high. But here's what he said. The United States currently deploys hundreds of nuclear missiles across Colorado, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, and Wyoming. Each missile carries a nuclear payload many times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, capable of killing hundreds of thousands of people. The Pentagon, and remember this is 2017, is now planning to build a new, deadlier generation of these missiles, which are housed in underground silos. But these ICBMs are not meant to be launched ever, not even in a nuclear war. Again, I'm still quoting from the article. Their primary mission is to be destroyed in the ground, along with all the people that live anywhere near them. Their main purpose is to, quote, absorb a nuclear attack from Russia, acting as a giant nuclear sponge. Such is the twisted logic of atomic warfare. I pause here a moment and say this is almost something you would believe was from a movie like Dr. Strangelove if it wasn't all too real, and apparently it is. Now I will continue reading. But it never made sense to draw a nuclear attack toward the United States rather than away from it. Even during the Cold War, analysts challenged this plan, claiming it was, quote, madness to use the United States real estate as a great sponge to absorb nuclear Soviet nuclear weapons. Yet the nuclear sponge is still with us, the article says. Not only that, the Trump administration, again, this is in 2017, is planning to spend $100 billion to do it all over again. Newly minted Defense Secretary Jim Mattis defended the ICBM and the nuclear sponge mission, although he did not call it that. Testifying before the Senate on January 12th, Mattis said, quote, it's clear they are so buried out in the central U.S. that any enemy that wants to take us on is going to have to commit 2, 3, 4 weapons to make sure they take each one out. In other words, the ICBM force provides a cost-imposing strategy on an adversary, unquote. And Kalina asked, cost-imposing for whom? Yes, attacking U.S. ICBMs would be very costly for Russia, mainly because the United States would retaliate with hundreds of nuclear weapons launched from submarines at sea. But what about the cost to Colorado, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, and Wyoming? Of course, we want to prevent nuclear war, but do we need to throw the upper Midwest under the bus to do it? Unquote. Are you kidding me? So this is, again, if you've ever seen Dr. Strangelove, this sounds like something that they would do. We're going to sacrifice Colorado, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, and Wyoming, and oh yes, all the people who live there to draw the nuclear fire down. This is interesting, folks, the nuclear sponge. You may be living in a nuclear sponge, as the email asks, so you might want to check that out if you are. Wow, fun fact known by few. And I use the word fun with quotes around it there. Okay, this one, a little less dangerous perhaps, but equally sort of, what the? This one goes back to September 5th of last year, 2023. What is hiding behind Lincoln's head on Mount Rushmore? Now that gets your attention, of course, immediately. And here's what it said. Gutzon Borglum, that is the man, of course, who carved Mount Rushmore, planned a massive Hall of Records, H-A-L-L, Hall of Records, as part of his Mount Rushmore design. The 80 by 100 foot room was to be drilled directly into the rock and would house historical documents like the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Congress eventually directed him to abandon the hall and stick with the faces. A 70-foot tunnel remains hidden behind Lincoln's head, containing 16 enamel panels telling the story of Mount Rushmore. The area is not open to the public. Are you kidding me? Who knew that this thing was there? Now, I will tell you, if you Google Hall of Records, Mount Rushmore, which I would suggest that you do, it's fascinating. The first thing that comes up, you go to a page on the National Park Service site, which, of course, they oversee the Mount Rushmore landmark, and read all about what he planned to do and what's actually there now. The idea was he thought that the carving on Mount Rushmore would last for thousands of years, but eventually no one would know who these people were or why, kind of like the Easter Island statues, right? What's happening here? Or Stonehenge? We don't know what's going on. So his idea was, we're going to carve this thing and we're going to put stuff in it that will explain what's happening out here on the mountain. So here's what it says on the website. Construction of the hall took place between July 1938 and July 1939 when a 70-foot tunnel was blasted into the mountain. It remains very rough cut and tapers to a point at the back. Work halted in 1939, as the email said, when Congress directed that construction should be executed only on the faces. With Borglum's death in 1941 and American involvement in World War II, all work on the memorial came to a close on October 31st, Halloween 1941. Now, still there. Although his grand scheme for the Hall of Records had to be abandoned, the idea remained. On August 9, 1998, Borglum's dream was completed when a repository of records was placed in the floor of the hall entry. This repository consists of a teakwood box inside a titanium vault covered by a granite capstone. Etched on the capstone is the following quote by Gutzon Borglum himself, and it says, "Let us place there, carved high, as close to heaven as we can, the words of our leaders, their faces, to show posterity what manner of men they were. Then breathe a prayer that these records will endure until the wind and rain alone shall wear them away," unquote. The repository, the website says, contains 16 porcelain enamel panels. Inscribed on the panels is the story of how Mount Rushmore came to be carved, who carved it, the reasons for selecting the four presidents depicted on the mountain, and a short history of the United States. This repository is not accessible to visitors, but is left as a record for people thousands of years from now who may wonder how and why Mount Rushmore was carved, unquote. In other words, folks, you remember that moment from Planet of the Apes when Charlton Heston on horseback comes across the blasted remains of the Statue of Liberty and realizes he's been on Earth all along? It's for that reason, thousands of years from now, when no one remembers why anyone ever took the trouble to carve the faces of these four men into the mountain, this thing will hopefully be there to tell. I had no idea. Had no idea such a thing was there. If you go online, you can see pictures of it hiding back there behind Lincoln's head. Absolutely fascinating. Finally, the last one from June 4th of this year. In 1900, engineers reversed the flow of the Chicago River, sending the city's pollution away from their source of drinking water, Lake Michigan, and directing it to the Mississippi River Basin. Now, it goes on to say, biologists are now concerned the river acts as a highway for invasive species like Asian carp, and now they're looking into re-reversing the river, which would cost about $4 billion. I thought, what? In 1900, what? They reversed the flow of a river? They could do that in 1900? They absolutely could. So I did a little investigation here. Yes, engineers reversed the flow of the Chicago River in 1900 by building a 28-mile-long canal. It's called the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. It took 8 years to complete. It removed approximately 42 million cubic yards of soil and rock. It got deeper as it moved west, allowing water to flow from the Chicago River into the canal and Lake Michigan. So here, understanding exactly how this works, and I do not claim that I still understand exactly how it works. I understand why they were trying to do this. What I can tell you is that the American Society of Civil Engineers named the project one of the seven wonders of engineering in the world in 1955. Here's what the Illinois State Archives has to say about it. The city of Chicago grew rapidly in the 19th century. This rapid growth caused problems with the city's infrastructure. One problem came from the drinking water. Lake Michigan served as the main source of drinking water for the city. However, it also served as the dumping ground for sewage from homes, businesses, factories, and the stockyards. A lot of the sewage was dumped first into the Chicago River, which flowed directly into Lake Michigan. Then, of course, it flowed back into Chicago. The sewage and pollutants in the water made Chicago residents susceptible to disease, especially cholera and typhoid fever. Chicago's solution to the problem was to reverse the flow of the Chicago River and build a canal connecting the south branch of the river to the Des Plaines River. From there, the sewage would flow down the river to the Illinois River and then the Mississippi River. From the Mississippi, it would, of course, flow to the Gulf of Mexico and, needless to say, no longer be Chicago's problem. In 1889, the Illinois legislature voted to create the Sanitary District of Chicago, a new taxing body charged with constructing a sanitary canal to be used to rid Chicago of its waste. So they started in 1892. 28-mile canal was built. As you would imagine, and this is still from the Illinois State Archives site, it says there was great opposition downstream from Chicago to the idea of the city sending its sewage that way. Rushing to open the canal before a lawsuit could be filed to prevent it, in the dead of night on January 1st, 1900, workers blasted open the last dirt separating the Chicago River from the canal, thereby reversing the flow of the river and sending Chicago sewage downstream. Acutely aware that there would be lawsuits from communities they felt were adversely affected, or that felt they were adversely affected by the sewage, and also wishing to document a truly historical construction project, the trustees hired photographers to document the work. From 1894 to 1928, more than 20,000 photographs were taken of the construction of the canal, the reversal of the river, and the ultimate effect on sites all along the Des Plaines and Illinois rivers. There's a note that the more than 20,000 black and white photos taken are housed on glass plate negatives in a special collection at the Illinois State Archives Margaret Cross Norton Building in Springfield. Who knew? Wow. And now they're talking about reversing the river. It would cost $4 billion. I think the original canal cost $33 million in 1890s money. Don't know exactly what that is and what it would cost today. But fun facts known by few. This stuff is fascinating to me. I had no idea that these things that I have described here existed or ever happened. And I will leave you with this final, this section anyway, this final one good fact that came from August 12th of 2023, a year ago. What beverage's name means water of life? And if you follow me on this podcast or any of my blogs, you know why I like this one. Whiskey, or depending on the place, that's spelled with an E-Y on the end or just a Y. Whiskey comes from the Irish and Scottish Gaelic, or water of life. And you know that's true. So as I mentioned at the beginning, we've got some great podcasts, I hope. I think they're going to be great. Some great interviews coming up with some authors as we go into the fall and winter. I just want to give you a preview of about seven of them that I've got coming up. Beginning with Jacqueline Jones, who is the winner of the 2024 Pulitzer Prize for History. She is going to be talking to me about her book, No Right to an Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era. This was published last year in 2023 by Basic Books, and it won, as I mentioned, the Pulitzer Prize in History this year, this past spring. It is a tour de force of research and writing. Jackie Jones, who is an old friend of the Georgia Historical Societies, will be on here to talk with me about that. Two books published recently by the University of Georgia Press. I have their authors coming up. The first is Greg Brooking, whose book, a biography of Georgia's third and final colonial governor, Sir James Wright, came out on July 15th. The book is entitled From Empire to Revolution, Sir James Wright and the Price of Loyalty in Georgia. It's a great book. Greg will be on talking about that. Also, out on August 1st, our old friend Paul Presley is going to be here to talk about his new book entitled A Southern Underground Railroad, Black Georgians and the Promise of Spanish Florida and Indian Country. Again, both of those books from UGA Press, that one out on August 1st. I'm also going to be talking to New York Times reporter Adam Nagorny, who will be covering the Democratic National Convention next week. Adam is going to talk to me about his book called The Times, How the Newspaper of Record Survived Scandal, Scorn, and the Transformation of Journalism. It was published last fall by Crown. Looking forward to talking to Adam Nagorny about that book. I'm also going to be talking to historian Evan Friss about his new book, which came out on August 6th, entitled The Bookshop, A History of the American Bookstore. And I don't mind telling you, friends, this is a book that I should have written. It was published by Viking, as I mentioned, came out on August 6th. And has been reviewed in the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. It's getting great reviews, and he will be on the podcast to talk about The Bookshop. I'm also going to be talking to my good friend Ben Parton, who was a PhD student of David Blight's at Yale. He is now teaching at Georgia Southern University. And Ben's book is going to be coming out in January from Simon & Schuster, and it's about Sherman's March. It's called Somewhere Toward Freedom, Sherman's March and the Story of America's Largest Emancipation. We're going to be talking to him. And also, after his book comes out on March 11, our dear friend here at the Georgia Historical Society, Steve Oney, is going to be my guest. Steve was on here a couple of years ago to talk about his previous book. And we're going to be talking about his new book. Now, Steve is going to be inducted as a Vincent J. Dooley Distinguished Fellow here at the Georgia Historical Society on September 12th. His book will be out on March 11th, and it's entitled On Air, The Triumph and Tumult of NPR, National Public Radio. Simon & Schuster is publishing this. It'll be out on March 11th, and Steve has generously agreed to come on and talk about his book. The last book he was here to talk about, by the way, was called A Man's World, which was a terrific book of a collection of his essays of people that he had written about. Steve is obviously author of the best book on the Leo Frank lynching, is called In the Dead Will Rise, that came out in 2003. He is a journalist, author, historian, and a fine gentleman. And so I'm very pleased. There are going to be others who are coming on. Haven't nailed those down yet, so I'm not going to go ahead and mention those. But we hope that you'll come back as we post these from week to week. Let us know how you like them, but I hope these you're going to enjoy these as much as I have enjoyed reading the books and will enjoy talking to the authors. And finally, I want to end this podcast is going to come out on August 16th. That, of course, is the anniversary of the death of the king. Elvis Presley died on August 16th, 47 years ago, 1977. I still remember exactly where I was. At my home in Snellville, Georgia, when my mother came in and told me that the king was gone. He was 42 years old. The king would be 89 if he were alive, and maybe depending on who you talk to, maybe he still is. But since we were doing fun facts known by few and this week in history, I think it only appropriate to mention the anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley. And I will say, one of the best songs, in my opinion, in my uninformed opinion, that ever came out about the death of Elvis Presley was a song called King Call, which came out in 1980 by a man named Philip Lynott, L-Y-N-O-T-T, who was the lead singer of the group Thin Lizzy. And he went out on his own in 1980 in tribute, which was just 3 years, of course, after Elvis's death. He came out with a song, and it's variously seen as either King's Call or King Call. It's King Call, but you really can't find it that way. And for years and years and years and years and years, you couldn't find it anywhere. I heard it on the radio in the summer of 1980. I liked it. I'm probably one of the very few people in the world who apparently did. It's only recently become available in all the places that you can find music, and I still enjoy listening to him talk about the profound effect that the death of the king had on him. So we remember Elvis Presley on August 16th. Hope you come back and enjoy Off the Eaten Path here in our eighth season. The hardest working producer and engineer in show business, the producer of this podcast, the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS Avocado launching team, is our very own and indispensable Brendan Cannonball Crellin. The captain of the GHS Italian wine tasting team is Rebecca PBR Bertina. Our GHS bouncer is Greg the Enforcer Durkin. All guest accommodations on Off the Eaten Path provided by the Horseshoe Road Inn. The director of the GHS Civil War Beard Division is once again Nate Brickwall Jackson Peterson. Our Off the Eaten Path fact checker is Ella Fino. The GHS director of accounts payable is Bill Shredder. The Off the Eaten Path stock market predictor is Luigi Board. The GHS table saw operator is Les Digits. Our director of employee loyalty is Upton Leftus. Our staff layoff specialist is Harry Verderci, assisted by layoff counselor Oscar La Vista. Our insurance claims liaison is Royal Payne Diaz. Our customer care specialist is Begonia Payne Diaz. The official Off the Eaten Path cheese expert is Gordon Zola. The GHS summer wardrobe consultant is Bermuda Schwartz. Our staff director of Three Stooges Studies is Lee Iapoca. Dr. Todd Gross's personal eBay specialist is Selma Junkoff. And our Off the Eaten Path martini mixer, thank you very much, is Olive Twist. You can find our podcast anywhere you can find podcasts, including now on YouTube and YouTube Music. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Be sure and like Off the Deaton Path on Facebook as well. Please also visit deatonpath.georgiahistory.com and check out Dispatches from Off the Deaton Path, my blog, and similar back-to-school nausea-inducing podcasts like this one. Stay safe, stay strong. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society. As always, thank you for listening.